Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Sluber, who's associate professor at Western Washington University. We'll be speaking about a fascinating work, his book is called Early Tantric Medicine, Snakebite, Mantras and Healing in the Garuda Tantras. Michael, welcome back to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So there certainly is a backstory in terms of how this book came about. Maybe tell us the primary object of the book and the discovery you made that allowed this book to be possible.
Sure. First say a little bit about what the book is about, and then I'll tell you the longest story about how it came to be. It's like the title suggests, this is a book about an early medieval medical system that's rooted in tantric rituals and mantras and some herbal medicine. And I'm specifically looking at the medicine for snakebite. And within that, you know, rather specific topic, I'm looking at the use of mantras to heal snakebite. So, it's kind of an interesting mix because a lot of people have studied history of medicine and a lot of people have studied history of religion, but this combines them in an interesting way that people in one of those areas or the other didn't really come to this topic. Snakebite may sound like this really obscure sort of thing. And I've even had people in India when I'm, you know, going there to give talks, they're like, you know, snakebite, really, that sounds very colonial, like you're exoticizing India by saying, you know, we have all these snake bites. But, you know, actually the data is there to show that there's a lot of snake bites happening in India, more than any other place in the world, even other countries combined. And about 45,000 to 50,000 people dying every year from snake bite. You know, now in the context of India, this place with almost 1.5 billion people, 50,000 people dying of snake bite is nothing, and yet it's still a lot of people. It's still, there's more to it than just the people that are dying. There's people that are permanently disabled. So, it really is. An important topic in some sense, and it has been an interest of the culture for literally thousands of years. So that's kind of the gist of the book. Let's see, how did I come to it? Yeah, do you want the short version or the long version?
Well, for me, it's always a scenic route, but whatever, you know, you've stumbled upon something in your research that is very important. And so I think folks would enjoy the story of how that came about.
Okay, sure. So, really it was about 10 years of my life actively working on this, you know, and that wasn't the only thing that I was doing in those 10 years, but it was like my main focus. But then when I reflect on this, I think there was another decade before that that really was leading up to it. So I'm going to start in middle school, which seems kind of silly. I've never like told the public this side.
Michael.
Yes.
I studied the Puranas. So there's a backstory to the backstory to the backstory. So by all means, let's start in middle school.
Okay. So I was into like magic, performing magic tricks, making a coin disappear, making a dollar bill float in the air, you know, these sorts of illusions. And, you know, this was just a hobby. But from there, you know, I hear about these people that claim to be practicing real magic. So I started studying this, you know, and I'm not studying it in some kind of naive way. Like I've been skeptical about magic all the way through. And I mean, maybe that partly starts with me starting as a performer, you know, doing this as something that I know that there's a trick behind it. And yet at the same time, I became sympathetic to these claims for real magic. And so I think that this led me in a very circuitous way to this study of religious medicine, which we could call magic. I mean, this is a big complex topic that scholars love to debate, like, you know, is magic an appropriate word to use? But I can't help but use it because there's so many similarities between things that we call magic, like spells and, you know, supernatural actions that can't be explained by natural laws and these sorts of things, and the way that some of the tantric medicine is thought to work. So there's that connection. So from there, you know, as a young teenager, I started studying other traditions of magic. I started studying Western esotericism. Very frequently, those traditions would be referring to India and referring to Tantra. So that was sort of on my radar. I also was interested in Native American healing traditions and shamanism, and I apprenticed with several different Native American shamans, learned healing techniques from them. I became a massage therapist at one point when I was about 18 years old and practiced on people and used visualization techniques. And, you know, at this point, okay, Tantra was sort of on my radar, but I really didn't know what it was. And so it's startling to me once I get into the research for this book about a decade ago that, or more than that now, that how similar some of the techniques that the tantric doctors were using to heal people were to these visualization techniques from the Americas. So all of this kind of sets the stage for me that it made me sympathetic to the worldview promoted by these early medieval texts. And I want to just, you know, reemphasize, sympathetic doesn't mean that I believed it all. Okay. Like, you know, as I said, I've been skeptical the whole way through. But I don't think that it's like an either or thing. You don't either believe in it or disbelieve it. I think that one can be curious about something, even if one doesn't accept it as the whole truth. I think that there's, you know, truth is multi-layered. And so that's the kind of perspective that led me to this this topic. When I was an undergraduate,
When
I was an undergraduate, I was interested in Tantra. You know, I heard more about it in my academic classes, and I read some of David Gordon White's books. But I kind of set it aside because I was pretty set on going to UC Berkeley and working with the Goldmans. They specialize in mythology and, you know, psychoanalytic studies and gender studies. And all of this was things that I was genuinely interested in. So I just kind of set Tantra to the side. And I planned on working on gender in the Mahabharata, you know, analyzing myths and stories, especially with regard to gender. So all of this shifted, like it pivoted 180 degrees back to Tantra, because the very first year that I started graduate school, and I had been there for a couple of years as an undergraduate studying Sanskrit, but the very first year in graduate school, the Goldmans were on sabbatical in India. And so the replacement Sanskrit teacher was Somdev Vasudeva, who is a specialist in Tantra. And so, you know, he had he gave us courses in reading manuscripts. And this was also something that was just super fascinating to me. This idea that one can make a living by reading old manuscripts and sort of like unearthing new knowledge was just, what really motivated me in the study of Sanskrit. And so, this just sort of set me off in a different direction and back in this direction of Sanskrit. So, in the course of that first semester, I came to Somdev and I showed him a list of manuscripts I was thinking about ordering from Nepal, ordering copies of. They have it all. They have like tens of thousands of manuscripts on microfilm there. And he saw the one that I ended up working on, Kriya Kala Gunotra, and he said immediately, order all the manuscripts of that one, because he knew that text had been referred to in the 11th century in a commentary on the Netra Tantra. Professor Alexis Sanderson, who was Somdev Vasudeva's teacher at Oxford, had recognized that text as something important. So it's demonstrably early, and it's inherently interesting. So I decided to work on that. And so that was the start of the 10 years of working on it in earnest.
And so how do you come across the Garuda Tantras?
Yeah, so I mean, that was basically just that text. I didn't know what the Garuda Tantras were, but because of Somdev's really enthusiastic recommendation, I ordered those manuscripts and I started reading them. I started transcribing one of them to start with and reading them and trying to make sense of them. That text also has a great deal of material on the Bhuta Tantras, which is something that I'm working on now as a separate project. But I decided to focus on the Garuda Tantra stuff probably because of the similarities that I saw with my previous interest in shamanism and healing techniques from the Americas. So that's kind of how I went in that direction of the Garuda Tantras. It's also just like, people think of Garuda, they hear that name and they think, kind of a knee-jerk reaction. Garuda is the mount of Vishnu. And like, there's not much more to be said about it. People consider him a minor god. But I found that like none of that applies to these texts. And actually it doesn't apply very well to most of what I encountered when I was surveying thousands of years of Sanskrit literature. In the Vaishnava context, certainly Garuda is the mount of Vishnu and, he's Vishnu's primary devotee and all of that. But there's all these other texts, the Shaiva Tantras, the Puranas, even way back in the Veda, Garuda is seen as this independent deity. This flows over into other traditions, in Buddhism and Jainism, Garuda shows up and is basically an independent deity, or he's presented as a devotee of the Buddha, for example. So all of this was mysterious to me and, intriguing just because it sort of flew in the face of conventional wisdom about this god.
Surely we see, it's not uncommon to see a folding in a Vaishnavization or a Shaivization, if those are words, of various figures such as Garuda or even Ganesha or et cetera, et cetera. So in the text that you're studying, who is Garuda?
Yeah, well, Garuda is basically the same as Shiva and Bhairava. So actually, I can read you a passage to go with that question because it's describing what the practitioner will do in a particular ritual. Let me find it here. Yeah, so one does all this preparation. I mean, there's a lot of background that I could explain about this, but basically one is doing a whole lot of preparation, working with these mantras, working with tantric visualizations. And then at one point of the ritual, it's as part of the preparation to actually heal a case of snake bite, according to the tradition. It picks up here where one is visualizing oneself as either Bhairava or Garuda. And it sort of blends them like there's not really much of a difference. So I'll just read a page here from the book. This stage of the ritual marks the transition between preparation and application. One visualizes oneself as Shiva in his frightening 10-armed Bhairava form pervading the entire universe with a fierce and penetrating fire. Next comes a crucial verse, and I quote, "At the time of the ritual, always visualize yourself as Bhairava to destroy demons, or indeed as the terribly powerful Tarksha," which is another name of Garuda, "to destroy snakes." So it's almost as if there's these two faces that Shiva has, Bhairava and Garuda, and the practitioner identifies with one or the other depending on what they want to do. So if they're working as an exorcist, then they identify as Bhairava in order to have authority over spirits. Whereas if they're treating poisons, then that's Garuda's domain. And so one identifies with him in that way. Visualize. So this is a visualization then that the practitioner is doing. Visualize your feet in the nether regions and wings pervading the directions. The seven worlds are on your chest with Brahmanda reaching your throat. So that's like the entire known universe up to the throat. Visualize your head extending beyond that as beginning with the Rudra Tattva and ending with the Isha Tattva, these higher realms of reality. Sadashiva and the three Shaktis stand on the crest of your head. The best sadhaka or tantric practitioner visualizes Tarksha as manifest, as both transcendent and immanent, pervading the worlds with three eyes, dreadful appearance, destroying poison and snakes, devouring nagas, and with a terrifying mouth, as an embodiment of the Garuda mantra and blazing like the fire of time. So here Garuda is no mere king of birds or vehicle for another god. He's coterminous with the highest reaches of the universe itself. One even gets the sense that he transcends Bhairava's function because of the chapter ends with the statement that snakes as well as various kinds of demonic beings flee on sight of such a man possessed by Garuda. Has he taken over Bhairava's role too? But perhaps this isn't an issue because Garuda and Bhairava were conceived as one and the same being. So that's, you know, that's my answer to who is Garuda in this context, that he really is the highest principle of the divine, but taking a particular face.
I've got a number of questions. Actually, I was going to say this to later, but I can't resist. Have you come across any living traditions surrounding this text or this thought?
Yes, but I haven't had the opportunity to do field work. So originally planning this project, I wanted to do a whole year of field work. I applied for the Fulbright Hayes Dissertation Fellowship. This was in 2010 or 11, and this was the year that the United States canceled the Fulbright Hayes program because we were spending too much money bombing Libya. So I didn't get to get funded to go do field work. So the living tradition that I've come across is all just, you know, through what other people have told me or finding references to it on the internet. So one of the traditional systems of snake bite medicine that is still somewhat alive, a living tradition, is in Kerala, and they call it Vishavaidya there. Partly based on Ayurvedic text, but also partly based on tantric traditions. The mantra system of it and these tantric visualizations had to go underground during colonialism because the royals were educated abroad and they were kind of scientifically minded and they didn't have much tolerance for religious healing. And so this basically gets excised from the text in Kerala, the Malayalam text of the Vishavaidya tradition. But you know, various people have told me, pieced together that you know, some in manuscript form, these texts that have the mantra portions of the snake bite medicine do still survive. Most people won't admit to practicing with mantras. You know, I think there's a concern about legal liability for one. So most of the practitioners there will only use herbal remedies, or at least this is what they say. I do get the impression that mantras are still used, but, you know, silently and not overtly, and they would be paired with herbal remedies.
Okay, perhaps talk about this at some point, but I can confirm for you that mantras are certainly used in healing paradigms, whether people are classically trained or their Vaidyas. But I can confirm for you that there are a number of health practitioners, indigenous health practitioners, who adopt these techniques in a covert manner. So I think your suspicion, I know, in fact, your suspicion is bang on. Enough about that.
And there's traditions all over South Asia too. So I lived in Nepal for a year and, I got a little bit acquainted with the shamanism there, and some of the oral text and the mantras that were shared with me seem to be related in some distant way to the Garuda tantras, like, certain structures of the mantras, and they're calling on Garuda and identifying him with Shiva. And so there seems to be a connection there in that living shamanic tradition in Nepal as well. So yeah, South Asia is so huge. There's things going on all over the place that it's hard to know everything.
Indeed. Absolutely. Tell us a bit about how the book is structured.
Sure. So there's two main parts. That's like the most overt structure. The first part is in English, sort of the book part of it, seven chapters plus a short conclusion, giving an overview of the history. The introduction starts with sort of my approach to the topic and some of the methodological concerns. We can circle back to that later. Second chapter, I'm looking at the early history, so Veda, early Pali canon, the epics, references to Garuda, references to healing snake bite with mantras, because that's the main interest, but also, herbal medicine is in there too. And then the third chapter gets into the proto-tantric and the tantric material, which really starts around 600-700 CE. So it's fairly early. It's pretty, we get references to it in the earliest tantras of Shaivism, and we get references to it in text of a similar date. So a lot of those original sources are lost. So, this is something I have to keep sort of referring to throughout the book, is I'm using these sources from several centuries later, but we know from references that the Garuda Tantras and the Bhuta Tantras were a thing. They were fairly influential, even from the seventh century or so. So I've sort of reviewed what we know about that. There's a few sources from these earliest canonical lists that survive. And then I go into chapter four is on the Vipati mantra in particular. And so this is the chapter of the book that I'm most proud of, because it's based on the study of manuscripts. I'm trying to think how to describe all this without getting too out of order. But yeah, the latter half of the book is just the edition and translation of the text. And that makes up a little more than half, actually. And so this chapter four is most closely based on that textual work. And so I feel like it's the most original thing that the book offers. And it was also the most difficult, because the text, reaches us in these manuscripts, never been edited before, in a modern context, it's never been printed. And so the manuscripts have errors. There's various places where the manuscripts disagree about what words the text is supposed to say. And so it's just this really difficult, really time-consuming process to sort out what this system was about. And so this, I feel like this chapter on the Vipati mantra, these five syllables of Garuda, is the heart of the book in that sense, that I put the most work into that section. And I think that mantra in particular is what made the Garuda Tantras popular. I mean, there's other mantras that go along with it. There's dozens of them, or even more. But that mantra and some of the features of it was so compelling that I think that this really sealed the popularity of the Garuda Tantras for the next 1,000 years and on down to the present. So yeah, I could get into specifics, but maybe I'll circle back so I can kind of finish telling you the overview. So the next chapter is on some different mantra systems. One principal one is called Nilakanta. And so, this is based on visualizing a form of Shiva and similar rituals as for the Vipati system. and then a chapter on snakebite goddesses. And yeah, I was already on the podcast earlier talking about my more recent book that involves some translations about goddess narratives. So that was started in this early tantric medicine research. Twarita is one of them, and there's several others, Kurukula and Berunda and Suvarnareka. So very interesting, previously little known goddesses that these sources inform us about. And then I have a chapter called Impact, where I just survey, you know, sort of post-classical tantra period, the impacts that the Garuda Tantras seem to have had on Ayurvedic medicine, on, you know, various Puranas, on Jainism, on Buddhism, on the Pancharatra, the Vaishnava Tantra tradition, and impacts on Himalayan art and architecture. And so just, you know, various ways that these texts have had influence down to the present, really. And then I kind of wrap it up. So yeah, like I said, the latter half of the book is a rather long edition and detailed translation of this one source, Kriya Kala Gunotra, that, you know, that seems to preserve the earliest account of the Garuda Tantras. So that's basically the structure.
Before we dive a little bit into the content, you had wanted to say a word about methodology you mentioned in passing.
Yeah, sure. So the methodology, I mean, it depends on exactly, you know, which part of the book we're talking about. So,
well,
I mean,
yeah, actually, if we can contextualize for a broader audience, maybe, what do manuscripts, like, what are you talking about? What's the state? What's the issue? What manuscripts, like, what's going on there?
Yeah, so handwritten text, you know, there's something, the estimates are that there's like 10 million manuscripts, handwritten books that reach the present. And there was probably tens of millions of others that don't reach the present. And this is referring to Sanskrit manuscripts. There's many more in other languages, of course. So India, in pre-modern times, before the printing press and all of this reaches India, it was this probably the most prolific literary culture on the planet. I mean, there was like orders of magnitude more reading and writing going on in India than anywhere else in the world, including, like, you know, all of Greek and Latin literature is much smaller than the corpus of Sanskrit literature. So it's just this enormous body of writings, of knowledge on every imaginable topic. And so these manuscripts are the best way to learn about texts in Sanskrit that haven't been heavily studied. And that's, frankly, most Sanskrit texts have not been well studied, and they haven't been printed in editions. You know, we have maybe 5 or 10,000 texts that have been printed in editions, but there's so many more than that are only existing in manuscripts that are held in these archives. So one of the best archives, the one that I use the most, is in Kathmandu, because the higher elevation of Nepal has means like it's a cooler climate and it's less humid. And so manuscripts tended to survive longer. So, you know, there's, of course, millions of manuscripts in India, too. But some of the oldest texts have died out in India, but survive in these manuscripts from further to the north.
And so you get a bunch of manuscripts, and then what? What do you do with them?
Okay, so yeah, get copies of the manuscripts. First, I ordered, like, you know, copies of the microfilm. These are black and white, pretty legible, but it's nice to work off of color. There's certain details when you're reading the text that, okay, you know, is that this letter, is that letter? So I went and I photographed the manuscripts at the National Archives in Kathmandu with a digital camera, and then worked off those color photographs mostly. Occasionally something was more clear in the black and white, so it was nice to have both. But yeah, you know, like, I take those photographs, I make a PDF of the entire text, you know, of those photographs. I make a table of contents to that PDF. So, like, you know, this chapter starts on this leaf of the palm leaf manuscript, so that I can jump around in the text that way. And then, you know, I have it open on the top of my screen, and then I have a text file open on the bottom, and I just start typing. And so it's really difficult to start out because one doesn't know the script very well. It's, you know, it's one, it's handwriting, so it's a lot more difficult to read than printed text. And then two, it's just you know, it's an older script. There's not really guides for, my knowledge of Devanagari certainly helped for some of the younger manuscripts, but for the oldest one, which was written about 850 years ago, the script was more archaic. So it just took a lot of time to figure out, because this isn't a text that has been printed. So I can't look and say, oh, this is saying that, you know, I'm just, you know, totally alone with the manuscript and trying to read it. But over time, you know, over the months of doing this every day, I did become very familiar with the handwriting. And so I can read it just as quickly as reading a printed text at this point for those manuscripts that I used.
So you got your file with all of this information that you've deciphered. Yes. And then what?
Yeah. So, and then, you know, you're reckoning with different manuscripts, because for the Kriya Kala Gunotra, we have in Nepal, there's like six main manuscripts that have the whole text. They're more or less complete. But then there are also six or seven others in India, mainly from Kashmir, some from Rajasthan, maybe one from Gujarat. And these got carried off into different libraries. So some of those I got copies from Paris or from London. But the first step is really to gather all copies of all the manuscripts so that I have it all there. And then I'm just going through and being like, okay, I'm trying to make sense of the text. And there's this difference here. Sometimes the differences are trivial. It's like they spell something different, but you can still recognize the word. Other times, all of the manuscripts say something that doesn't seem intelligible. And so I think about it for a long time, and then I go read other text, and, you know, I search through digital text files of thousands of other texts that people have typed in to try to find parallels. And so working that way, I can often amend the text. So this is a word we use when the scholar comes up with a different reading than what the manuscripts say, but which has a rationale behind it, which can explain what the manuscripts say. So, you know, sometimes it's very simple and you know right away what the correct reading should be and how the error came about. But other times it's more speculative. And then, you know, you have to kind of mark it as a conjecture that not really sure what the text should say here, but maybe it should say this. And so, you know, we have extensive notes that go along with it to leave a record of our decision. So, that's a methodological thing about this edition of the Sanskrit text, is I keep a record of everything every manuscript says. And so the reader can, if they're reading it, they can refer down and see what the variants are, and they can decide Slober made the right decision here or Slober didn't make the right decision here, because they can kind of look over my shoulder at the choices that I made and the rationale that I give.
This reminds me of the so much of what I do, but the Mahabharata's critical edition project, or really the Ramayana the critically edited Puranas. It's the stuff that was left out is gold, because oftentimes you will think, wow, that story that Pakyana is like, that's the Rosetta Stone for understanding these two episodes. And so, you know, you have the option, you know, you do the best you can, you justify your decisions, and then you leave breadcrumbs for posterity as you see fit.
I mean, people have, some even very senior scholars have this misconception about critical editions that there's like this mechanical method that you follow that you use to arrive at the final word on a text. And so that's totally not the way it works. There is no final word. Any edition is a hypothesis. A critical edition where you're listing all of those variants is a hypothesis with evidence to back it up. So, anyone can come along at a later point and make improvements or see what I've done and agree with it. So it's just preserving all the evidence for people to look at. Yeah.
So you've got your edition that you've agreed that you're going to use for your work. And then what's next step? Or what was the next step for your particular book?
Yeah, well, really, that took probably 3/4 of those 10 years was doing the textual work.
Oh, I believe you. You're a braver man than I am. in that regard.
You know, But after preparing that, you know, the next step for me was contextualizing it. So, you know, I had been doing this all along because as I'm reading this text, I want to be reading it in context of what are other Sanskrit texts saying and, you know, what's up with Garuda being in this context. So the contextualization was happening all along, but I, you know, didn't write it up until after having done the textual work because, you know, that's the textual work is really the solid base on which all those other contextualizations are founded. So, you know, there's a lot that went into this book. Another thing, you know, you may not expect was that I had to learn quite a lot about modern scientific understandings, you know, in the study of toxicology and herpetology, behavior of snakes, and, you know, what do modern doctors recommend that you do during a snake bite? And, you know, how does antivenom work? And why are people so dismissive of traditional medicine? And so, you know, I read a lot of scientific journal articles and I was, you know, I try to kind of strike a balance between being very informed about the science, but not letting it make me dismissive of this medieval medical system. There's a whole lot of scholars, there's a whole lot of scholarship, there's a whole lot of scientists and doctors that are extremely dismissive of anything that's not modern medicine. They're like, you know, everything that came before was absolute nonsense. It wasn't based on evidence. So that sort of attitude is what prevented this book from being written until I got to it, because there was just not any sense that there might be something interesting or valuable there.
And yet I know a number of Ayurvedic practitioners, and yet there is great utility in terms of track record and healing with various paradigms that might be considered more holistic or that sort of have a model of the human being that is trans-empirical. I mean, there are dimensions that are sukshma, however you want to think of it. And there are so many individuals who, whether out of folly or desperation or wisdom, will not gain the results they're looking for through a modern Western medical paradigm and gain right. Fantastic results elsewhere. And of course, there are a lot of charlatans and a lot of people who are deluded and everything in between. But nevertheless, these systems of medicine have survived for centuries, not because they're complete madness. That couldn't be the case.
Right. So, you know, that's the critical thing is that everything in between that, you know, too many people think of this issue of different systems of medicine as an either or, that it's, you know, you either believe in modern medicine or you don't, you know, and
like, it's all, I've said this before on this podcast. It's all about the both and for all things Indic, especially Sanskrit narrative. It's all about the both and, but anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, one point in favor of this traditional medicine for snake bite is on the herbal remedies side, there have been scientific studies that have taken, you know, these herbs into their lab. They've made extracts of them, injected it into to lab rats, and also injected the snake venom. And they've shown, you know, without a doubt that some of these herbal remedies do have amazingly strong anti-venom properties. That it can, you know, snake venom is really strong stuff. Like it can kill you within minutes if it's a bad enough bite. It can totally destroy your tissues. You know, people lose limbs. Like it's really strong stuff, but so are certain herbal medicines. And so they've confirmed this in lab studies. And there's been a proliferation of this since I wrote the book. Even I had a student that sort of looked into what's been done since. And there's just been dozens and dozens of evaluations of herbal medicines that, you know, typically not drawn from texts. These scientists are choosing which ones to evaluate based on folk medicine. But sometimes those two overlap. And so there's a certain plant that the text that I work on say use this plant for, it's called palasha in Sanskrit. They say use this for viper bite, you know, for a particular type of viper. And that one I found there was a study done and it's remarkable as an antivenom. So, but we're still in this sort of paradigm that the scientists doing these studies aren't really being heard by the broader medical community. because we're in this paradigm that says anti-venom, like that's made by, you know, this technique that they've been using since the 1800s, but you know, they milk the venom from the snake, they inject it into a horse, and then they take the horse's blood and they purify out the antibodies that the horse creates to counteract the snake venom. So that type of anti-venom is what is still rules the day. Like all the world health literature is saying, you know, traditional medicine is just a waste of time. Like anti-venom is the only way to deal with this issue. But anti-venom comes with its own problems. So yeah, I don't want to go too off track here, but you know, anti-venom can be very allergenic, and it's not always appropriately used. It's not always used in a clinic that is well enough equipped. So anyway, I think there's a case to be made that some traditional forms of medicine, not all of it, of course, some traditional forms of medicine actually work and might actually hold better potential for non-allergenic treatments of snake bite. There's not a lot of sympathy for that in the global health.
Well, the fact is that we have more evidence that we know what to do with, but you have to separate the wheat and the chaff. We've got thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases with some ailments, millions of people who are treated in Ayurvedic or various paradigms that don't require any sort of belief or sleight of hand, where they'll give it a shot and they'll gain the results. And so it's when evidence is threatening to our worldview, whether in the scientific or political or religious, it's when evidence is threatening to the scaffolding in one's mind, the worldview, that, you know, it's sidelined sometimes to be charitable as a defense mechanism or in the interest of following a paradigm. And sometimes it's just too difficult to, when they discovered the Indus Valley civilization a century ago, they just deduced or assumed that it must be an offshoot of Mesopotamia. Because how could such a thing exist? How could such a thing exist in South Asia? And so it's just clearly we all have biases. Every civilization does. Every paradigm does. And without question, there's no shortage of studies on the efficacy of various paradigms, including ancient Indic forms of medicine or holistic medicine. But I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at what you say in terms of it threatens a particular paradigm, worldview, power structure. And so it's challenging to use, you know, you have to take that medicine with a grain of salt, so to speak. Listen, what do you hope folks most take away from this work?
Yeah, well, I feel like there are four main contributions that it makes. I mean, one is just the Garuda Tantras exist, because before this book, they're really like there was a couple scholars that had referred to them like with a paragraph or a page, but really, like, you know, didn't say much. They said they're basically lost. So a lot of them have been lost, but they exist. They existed, and a lot of compendia were written on the basis of them, such as the scriptural compendia, the Kriya Kalagrinotra, that had preserves a lot of fascinating materials. So, you know, these are referred to by so many other areas of Sanskrit literature. There's like intellectuals referring to them, poets, philosophers, you know, fiction writers, bhakti poets, shamans, yogis. They're all talking about the Garuda Tantras, but like people just like, what is this? Like they're referring to Garuda. I'm like, what does that mean? You know, something having to do with snake bite. So I feel like that's one of the biggest contributions of the book, is just like, here it is. This is what it is. This is what it was. And it's something to be aware of, because there was that lack of awareness, that ignorance before. I mean, also just the fact that Garuda is not minor in these texts and in many other contexts, that he was a pretty important god in the Veda. He was identified with the sun, you know, with Agni, and like, you know, this is like major stuff for the Vedic religion. So not a minor god, not only the Mount of Vishnu, very influential. You know, even just like looking at the news this morning, I see this, you know, report about Indonesia and the United States and a bunch of other countries doing these military exercises, and they're calling it the Super Garuda Shield. Like, that's happening right now. So, I mean, the influence is clearly there all over Asia, of this God. And so, we have to stop doing the knee jerk thing and just, like, you know, categorizing a deity as one thing, because Garuda was so much more. Other takeaways from the book: mantras are definitely not meaningless or irrational. They may be irrational in your worldview, in one's modern worldview, but they're not irrational to the people that use them.
far from it.
Full of meaning. You know, so this is this chapter on the Vipati mantra where I get into the nuts and bolts of what these mantras mean, and so many layers of meaning, so many complementary interlocking layers that are used in those rituals. So, you know, a lot of scholars before just were like, mantras are meaningless, or mantras are bird songs, you know, or, you know, it's just like some unintelligible mumbo jumbo. Definitely not the case. So, you know, that's something I want to drive home with this book. And then, yeah, just as we've been talking about, like, I want people to take away that we should be more open-minded. That doesn't mean changing what we do. You know, it doesn't mean you don't go to the hospital when you get bitten by a snake. I think people should be safe and do what they need to do. But, like, intellectually speaking, we can be curious about what other people have done in the past and what some people still do to this day. Why do they do it? How might it work, or how might it not work? You know, there's all sorts of interesting ways that these texts were accurate. I mean, there's ways that there's sort of plenty of ways that they were inaccurate, but there's also things that they knew that a lot of doctors still don't really fully understand today about how the venom works in the body. I'll give an example of that if we have time.
Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah, so one of the things in the text to describe how the venom goes through these different tissues in the body, it starts in the skin. It's easiest to cure when it's in the skin. If you get it right away, very easy to counteract the venom. But over time, it goes deeper into the tissues, into the blood, into the muscles, into the bone marrow, finally. And so once it settles in the bone marrow, they say it's incurable. So this is remarkably detailed kind of physiological description of how venom progresses through the body. And, you know, I found that looking into this is basically how the really informed scientists understand the action of anti-venom, is that it only works if the venom is freely circulating in the blood. If you wait too long to go to the doctor and get anti-venom treatment, it's not going to be very effective because the venom already settles into the tissues. So it's pretty much exactly the way, you know, broadly speaking, it's pretty much the way that they described this over 1,000 years ago. So I just continue to be astounded at some of these insights that doctors had with far fewer, you know, far less technology and, you know, sophisticated tools that we have today, that they really got some things very right.
Well, it really seems to me, and I this is an idea that comes up relatively frequently in teaching contexts, in conversations. It seems to my mind a sort of a glaring conceit that pre-moderns were unthinking. Or, I mean, look at listen, in the human experience, there are always going to be people who are extraordinarily good at scrutinizing, picking apart ideas, critically thinking, figuring out how something works, whether that's whether that's a chariot, or whether that's a human body, whether it's building a temple. This would have always been the case. There's no reason whatsoever to question whether or not the ancients were capable of critical thinking and practical application of knowledge. I think what trips people up is the code switching between spiritual or sort of sukshma modes versus stula modes. And I think folks take that code switching as evidence of the inability to think straight.
Mm.
And I think, you know, an Ayurvedic doctor, a naturopath, or whomever, you've got to cut. If you need an antibiotic, or if you need a Band-Aid, or you need gauze, then that's what you're going to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think part of the reason why I arrived at this is because I know a number of practitioners who are fully capable of treating a gross problem on a gross level. And I'll use an example. This hits home for me because in the last couple of years, I've had more health issues than I've had in my whole life combined. Mm. Four or five relatively, issues have cropped up, and it was instinctive to me. I'm like, this can't be the case. These are cropping. It can't be a case. This is just a stroke of bad luck or whatever. Mm. There's got to be something in the physiology. I don't know enough about physiology yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a bit of a rebel of someone of South Asian descent in that I didn't study medicine or engineering. Anyhow, and it was only very
clear that there was something deeper going on.
It was abundantly clear to me, both in terms of what I was feeling in my body, but also to my rational mind, that these things can't just crop up out of nowhere, and they seem unrelated, but they can't be. Because I haven't had any of these issues before. They're all cropping up within 12 to 18 months. I go to an Ayurvedic doctor, highly skilled Ayurvedic doctor, but also highly skilled in regular Western medicine. And within 2 minutes, he points to the syndrome that is the underlying cause of all of this. And if you Google it, there is even a great Mayo Clinic article on this. It's not that allopathic medicine is not aware of this. It's that folks aren't always good at thinking holistically or pattern recognition, right? Mm-hmm. So folks get, and the smarter we get and the more we study, the more in a crevice we live, right? Mm-hmm. And so 2 minutes, it's like, this is the syndrome, this. And he even alluded to two other issues that I didn't even mention to him because I didn't want to overburden him. He's like, you're going to have this probably. I'm like, yep. Because he was able to see a broader picture.
Yeah.
So nice. That's not to say that there isn't a whole lot of, you know, dogma, superstition, and God knows what in a variety of religious traditions and texts and paradigms. But I couldn't agree with you more that that we need to consciously overcome the conceit that other modes of medicine or anything before, you know, a certain century in European culture was capable of. Yeah, rational thought, right?
Absolutely. And also just the lumping together, like, you know, any biomedical doctor is going to be able to make that diagnosis. No, you know, like you're saying, a lot of them are not seeing the bigger picture, which isn't to say that none of them would, because, you know, some might be really spot on and present when they're, you know, talking to you and evaluating your symptoms. And some wouldn't. So, you know, you can't just say this whole system is wrong or this whole system is right. Yeah, there's the individual doctors that have their talents that
absolutely
may be able to treat you or not.
Absolutely. Is there, let's see, were there any other food groups that should be on the buffet? Is there anything else about the book or your journey that you'd like to share?
Yeah, another food group, poison, because sometimes poison was used as a medicine. Very, very dangerous, very interesting. But I think, you know, we're probably getting a little over time, so I could leave that.
I'm perfectly fine. I've got the time. I don't have a commitment in the next hour, so I'm okay. And if folks are bored, which they won't be, they can always fast forward. It's a podcast, so go for it.
So these early texts that I edited refer to using poisons, plant poisons, medicinally, both to counteract snake venom in some cases and just as a general tonic or to heal other health conditions. They handle it fairly cautiously, you know, by the standards of 1,000 years ago. They say don't use it in these conditions for people that are very young or very old. And they say you have to do a test for what's basically an allergic reaction. You have the person hold a little bit of the plant venom in their hand and see how their body reacts to it. And then they start very slowly by giving these minute amounts. And, you know, claim very, very grand benefits. I mean, I think a lot of the claims are just way over the top, like, oh, you'll live for 300 years and still look like you're 16. I don't believe that, but, you know, maybe some of
It's artifada, right? It's hyperbole.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I think one has to be really careful with this sort of thing. It has to be stated that this wouldn't work for all types of poison, even taking minute amounts, because some poisons build up over time in the body. And so one doesn't want to dabble with this without truly understanding it. But it's not as off the wall as it might first appear, because if you think about it, you could compare to modern pharmacology. There's a lot of pharmaceutical drugs that doctors prescribe that are essentially poisons. I think of warfarin, for one, marketed as Coumarin. It's like used as a blood thinner to prevent blood clots for people that have had a stroke. This was started as a rat poison. Like, it literally is a poison. And so sometimes older people that I've talked to joke about it, but, you know, it's literally a poison that's used medicinally in modern medicine. So one has to know what one's doing and get the dosage right and, you know, not take a poison that builds up in the body. But in principle, this idea is not as off the wall as it may appear at first glance. So if one comes into it with an open mind, one can sort of see the logic of how it might have worked.
Fascinating. You know, I'd like to touch on a couple of things you mentioned at the outset about your journey and your interests in how you got into this field of research and writing this book. Has your perspective changed since you were in middle school about magic? First of all, magic in terms of, a magician as an illusionist versus a magician as, for lack of a better word, an occultist. You know, has your perspective changed, I wonder, in that journey? And also, when you say magic or when you say, you know, considering some of these references or practices as magical, I'm not going to ask you to define that because that's a ridiculous thing to do. But I wonder if that's, do you mean, is that, does that roughly equate the supernatural? Is that what you mean by magic?
That's what I was going to say. And that is how I would define it if you're going to put me on the spot to define
it. No, I wouldn't put you on the spot.
No, but that's exactly what I was going to say, is supernatural, that it's, maybe it's claiming to work supernaturally, or at least it, the way that it works is not, doesn't seem to be based on the laws of nature. So that's what I mean by magic. But the line between magic and religion is very blurry. And in the West, that idea of magic has tended to be used to disparage traditions like, you know, magic as opposed to religion, which is,
don't call the Eucharist magic, right?
Exactly. But I would, you know, not draw the fine line in the sand there. So if my perspective's changed, yes and no. I mean, I feel like I'm probably more careful and more skeptical than I was, you know, when I was 13 years old. I was more naive. I didn't believe everything at that point, though, you know, but I had a stronger desire to believe than I do now. So, you know, I've kind of found the middle point of neither believing nor disbelieving, that I would like it if supernatural things were real. And I've had experiences that I can't explain, but I'm not a believer. You know, I'm not going to be out there saying people should believe this. And I'm not, you know, sure that my experiences were supernatural. I just don't know how else to explain them. So I feel like that kind of in between is a comfortable place for me. And I feel like more people should be able to find that place in between, that you're not stuck into belief or disbelief.
Well, it seems to my mind, ironically, as a more objective mode of inquiry, where one isn't tethered by what one expects to find your belief, where one has an open, you know, a more open mind in terms of what one is engaging in, and having that sort of that openness to possibility. In its absence, one has blind spots and one may miss certain things because one is looking at certain things in certain ways. And I think the fact that you're more careful and skeptical, to my mind, yay, the academy has done its job. I mean, because, you know, after 3 degrees, one would hope on some level. Having said that, and I return to this idea over and over again, when people are studying the human experience and humans, clearly what's going on is more than meets the eye, and one has to leave room for the possibility that we're more than bots made of flesh, right? Like, there's stuff going on, right? Clearly.
We need to be humble. Yeah. Because, you know, knowledge now is not what knowledge was 100 years ago, and it's not what knowledge will be 100 years from now. And so we need to be a little bit humble and understand that there may be things going on that we can't explain now that we will be able to explain later.
Right. And are there other types of knowledge? So are there types of knowledge that are derived through different means, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you for indulging.
And nonverbal knowledge too, because, you know, we tend to think everything that is knowledge can be written down, but there's certain ways of knowing and bodily ways of knowing that cannot be easily put into words, that have to be transmitted through touch, and for example.
Or glance.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Michael Stuber on his fascinating OUP 2017 publication, Early Tantric Medicine, Snakebite Mantras and Healing in the Garuda Tantras. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the mysteries of medicine. Take care.